So these are the common features of the perennial philosophy and the course, and I think you can see how it fits into this perennial philosophy, this millennia-old tradition, this great tradition of the accumulated wisdom of humankind. I think you can see that it embodies this wisdom in a form that is unique and appropriate for our time. There are also a couple of unique features of the course, and I'll just briefly mention those. One is the organization. Unlike practically all other major spiritual teachings, the course is organized, coherent, and complete. You know, most of the teachings we have are assembled from the sayings of sages years afterwards, and you know, we have just a few hundred lines from Jesus or a few thousand lines from the Buddha. They're collected in a semi-random fashion. But the course is laid out from step one, the beginning, through 365 lessons, to the end in a coherent, organized, logical thought system. Cosmology. The course provides, as far as I know, a unique perspective on the nature of the world, the universe, by saying that we, i.e. the collective child or son of God, have created this. And this provides a very interesting answer to what has been perhaps the major stumbling block for all theistic religions, that is the question of suffering. How could an omnipotent God allow such suffering in the world? Well, the Course's perspective is that this world is the creation of our own collective dreaming minds, and that it's not a creation of God, it is something we have made together. Third unique feature of the Course, relationship. The Course is the only path I know in which the primary vehicle of awakening is peer relationship. Now, there are other paths such as Bhakti Yoga where relationship is crucial. But it's not a peer relationship. It's devotion to a god or guru, teacher. But the Course is unique in emphasizing as the means for awakening making holy peer relationships, using our relationships as the means for awakening. And this may be particularly appropriate for our time, since this is the first time in history we have had such freedom to choose relationships, particularly romantic relationships. There's one final feature of the course which is not unique, but it is uncommon, and it's also crucial. This is what's sometimes called by Dar Frijon, by Ken Wilber, the perspective of always already truth. You can divide the world's spiritual traditions into paths of attainment or paths of recognition. Paths of attainment assume that there is some inherent deficiency within us which requires correction, and that awakening therefore means we have to do something to correct ourselves or to fill up some deficiency. And we need time in which to do it. So therefore, salvation or liberation can only occur in the future. On the other hand, as opposed to these paths of attainment, there are paths of recognition. And in these paths of recognition, what is entailed is not a correction, but simply a recognition that we are always already that which we are seeking. We are always already one with God, unseparated, pure, holy, boundless, limitless, Satchitananda, etc., etc., etc. All that we are seeking, we are always already are in this moment and every moment. There's a wonderful dialogue between Alan Watts and the Tibetan master Tathang Tulku. They were going to dialogue on enlightenment. Alan Watts started the debate saying, "What must one do to attain enlightenment?" And Tathang Tulku said, "Nothing." End of debate. And as the Course says in Lesson 188, "The peace of God is shining in me now." Why wait for heaven? Those who seek the light are merely covering their eyes. The light is in them now. Enlightenment is but a recognition, not a change at all. And in the section of the text called "I Need Do Nothing," wonderful statement. You are prepared. Now you need but to remember you need do nothing. It would be far more profitable now merely to concentrate on this than to consider what you should do. When peace comes at last to those who wrestle with temptation and fight against the giving into sin, when the light comes at last into the mind given to contemplation, or when the goal is finally achieved by anyone, it always comes with just one happy realization: I need do nothing. Here is the ultimate release, which everyone will one day find in his own way, at his own time. You do not need this time. Time has been saved for you because you and your brother are together. This is the special means this course is using to save you time. So the fundamental message of the paths of already truth and of the course is that we need do nothing. Sometimes it takes a little while to let that sink in. And as long as we still believe we need to do something, I know of nothing better to do than A Course in Miracles. Thank you very much.
What we'd like to do right now is take about 15 minutes for questions and answers, and then we'll have a quiet time guided meditation led by Roger, and then we'll, if we have some more time, pick up with a few more questions and answers. So if anyone has a question right now, what I'd invite you to do is come up to the microphone so that this can be on the tape as well, and the answer.
Or comment also.
I'd like to ask you to say a few words about how you integrate the course into your daily work world.
Integrating into daily life. Let's see. I guess for me there are a couple of areas. One is the content of the course, the ideas in the course, and the other is the question of being the course. I think the second probably being the more important. And I guess in terms of integrating, those are two dimensions that all of us face. The content of the course, I find myself speaking about either openly or covertly or not at all, depending on the situation and audience I'm with. There's a wonderful line from Muhammad: speak to each person according to their level of unwillingness of understanding. And sometimes it feels very appropriate to speak openly about the course, other times it feels very inappropriate, and other times it's probably appropriate and I'm just scared. So one thing I am able to do by virtue of my position and profession, which is psychiatrist, I find myself in the very, very fortunate position of being able to communicate the ideas in the course through the terms and concepts and language of psychology. And the course, one of the unique features of the course is that among spiritual traditions it is extremely psychologically oriented. So there's an enormous amount of psychological wisdom there. So I'm able to give lectures at the university using some of the ideas from the course and being very quiet about their origin. And also being able to communicate some of these ideas in reframe them within the language which people will find acceptable. Now, this is a task which all of us face, of course, and it's a perennial task for people who are attempting to communicate spiritual wisdom. Because one of the tasks of anyone working to share spiritual wisdom is to communicate it in a way which people can understand. And such a person has been called by Carl Jung a Gnostic intermediary. A Gnostic intermediary is someone who imbibes a wisdom tradition so deeply into themselves that they're able to speak about it directly from their own experience and communicate it in the language and concepts of that person so that that person has an aha experience. Oh, of course. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay? Now, usually spiritual traditions get ossified. They get cast and solidified into the language and terms and ideas of the centuries in which the tradition was founded. And then we have the idea that the only wise sage that could possibly exist must have lived at least a couple of thousand years ago. And the task then is to translate that wisdom into contemporary concepts and language. And then the task of the Gnostic intermediary is this threefold process of becoming wise, imbibing the wisdom, learning to translate it into the appropriate language, so that the person is able to understand. And I'd suggest that it is true that Uncle Sam really does need you. Become a GI, become a Gnostic intermediary. That's what we really need. So that I think for all of us, the task is not only one of communicating the Course directly, but also becoming it and then just communicating it in ways which people can understand. And each of us has a particularly unique skill or task or profession. Our task is how can we communicate it through our work, through our unique relationships, etc. So I guess for me it's an ongoing challenge. I assume I'll be spending the rest of my life trying to learn how to do this more effectively.
Yeah. Hi. That was a great talk. I really loved it.
Thank you.
When I first got involved in enlightenment or whatever, at least looking at, there was a saying: when you're up to your ass in alligators, it's hard to remember that your purpose was to drain the swamp. And one of the things that seems to be true of almost everything I encounter is that we recognize we're up to our ass in problems, and our purpose is to get out of the problem. But it seems like that there's more to. I guess I'm bothered by the idea that somehow the child of God slipped up and fell in the swamp. It seems like that maybe we had a purpose in this exploration of separation, if I could call it that. And I wonder if the Course has, not many people have addressed why mankind is here at all. I think Buckminster Fuller said it was to, add to God's knowledge of this area of the universe. I wonder if the Course or anything else has anything to say about, why did we do this crazy, insane thing in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the Course suggests, of course, that we didn't. That it's all illusion, and the separation was false. Separation is illusion in the first place. So that the Course's response to that is, why did we separate? Is that we didn't. Only in our dreams did we think it so. But that still leaves the question I think you're asking, which is a very profound one, which has vexed a lot of great minds throughout human history. And the Course doesn't give a positive answer such as I think you're asking for. Although some other traditions do, for example, in some varieties of Hinduism, there's the idea that Brahman explodes out into manifestation in order to play the game of cosmic hide-and-seek. So the fragments of Brahman can pretend to forget that they are Brahman, and Brahman can play this infinite game of self-discovery. So. And eventually the component parts, us, realize our unity with Brahman and unite, and then we explode back out to play the game again. don't know. I guess that's the bottom line answer, don't know. Actually, that was probably going to be my answer to a lot of questions. Thank you.
I've been struggling in my study of the Course with this. It seems to me that the Course does not handle Jung's idea that to be whole, you have to acknowledge the shadow. And of course, Freud talks about the id and so on. And Jung also said that man needs difficulties. They are necessary for his health. I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Could you say a little more about the Course doesn't acknowledge the shadow? Because my perception is it does. Maybe you could say a little more about that.
Well, as you do the lessons, the idea seems to be that you see God in everything, and that as you see God in yourself, you see God in objects,
mm-hmm.
and. That okay. Kind of steps over the.
Okay. I think I see what you're getting at. That I think is actually one of the more common criticisms of the Course, and also of the whole transpersonal psychology movement, the movement in psychology to integrate psychology and spirituality. Actually, there are parts in the Course which are pretty horrific. I mean, some of the descriptions of the ego, they make it clear this is a pretty bloodthirsty beast, and its aim, fundamental aim of the ego is to crucify ourselves and others and do all sorts of nasty things. So it's in there. The aim of the lessons clearly is, specifically the Course says, you can't escape darkness by analyzing it, or you escape darkness by moving towards light. So its emphasis is, I think you're right, is more on the light. It describes it as that being a strategic path rather than excessively focusing on the dark. But it makes very clear, that, for example, you've got to, the Holy Spirit can only remove as much fear as you're willing to recognize, that you have to, that the negativity can only be released in as much as you're willing to acknowledge it's there, etc. So it is there. I think it's the emphasis is not on it, though. So I guess I see your I understand your point, but I think the Course also does address that somewhat.
Well, I think of pearls, the emphasis that in recognizing and expressing hostility and the negative feelings, there's a certain power in that.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the direct expression, yeah. Yeah, the Course is not big on expressing anger and those negative emotions, for sure. And that's really one of the major differences between some of the spiritual traditions and the psychotherapies. If those of you who may have been at the Harmonium Mundi conference in Newport Beach last October and saw the dialogue between the Dalai Lama and the Western psychologists, that was one of the points he really wanted to thrash out with them. We really think, he said, we in Buddhism think it's very dangerous to express anger, but I hear that you feel this is a positive step. My own understanding is that it can be understood developmentally, that most of us have a lot of judgment and condemnation on anger, so that for many of us the first step is removing the judgment, condemnation, and guilt around anger and aggression, and just accepting and forgiving ourselves for having it. And that may entail, of necessity for some of us, I think, a period where we do express it. Unfortunately, one of the traps of the human potential movement seems to have been to think that the highest form of human existence is to be able to be angry. Instead of realizing that it's only a step on the way, and it's maybe a useful step on the way to relinquishing it. Not by suppression, not by repression, not by denial, but by fully opening to accepting, forgiving oneself for having, and then working to let go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. What is the difference? You were talking about the ego and fantasizing. I do a lot of visualizations and goal settings.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the difference in that? Because that gives my ego like a boost, like a charge for my goal setting and my visualizations.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that an illusion? Because it's not a fact. It is kind of a fantasy in a sense, right?
Uh-huh.
So how is that?
The Course would say it's okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
So I was just thinking about that, because when you were talking about the dream state and all that, and I was trying to think about how to do that, because I do visualizations and affirmations every day, and that keeps me in the positive and those things, but they are fantasies and they are dreams.
Yeah, but the difference is you're aware they're fantasies and dreams.
Oh, okay.
The tragedy is when we don't recognize our fantasies and dreams for fantasies and dreams and mistake them for reality.
And, of course, when things come up, then those are subject to change and all that type of thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'd like to clarify probably a couple of somatic questions. You mentioned reality there. What I'm really interested in is happy dream. Is that the real world?
Is the happy dream? I don't know. Is the happy dream the real world? I'm not thinking too clearly. I think it is. Does anyone want to
Let me tell you what another tag to that is, that in part of it, it talks about the two worlds.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that that's the ego world and the real world, or the wrong-minded world and the right-minded world. And it uses real, but it says, but both worlds are not true. They're both illusions. Mm-hmm. But the word real is used all the time.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, in the introduction, in the summary, where it talks about nothing real can be threatened,
nothing, yeah.
Unreal exists.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm having a little trouble at the moment just linking up real world and happy dream. My off-the-cuff reaction is the happy dream is a more general term, and the real world, I think, is described, as I can I'm only vaguely remembering at the moment, as like the final moment before awakening. And if someone has that clearly in mind, I'd be happy to be corrected here.
Well, the real world is the illusion free of sin and guilt.
Maybe. We could think of the real world as the world of illusion that is free of sin and guilt.
Mm-hmm.
The forgiven perception of our brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Just one follow-up point on that. The Course does at times use words in different ways, real being one of them. Another is judgment. Sometimes it uses judgment meaning condemnation. Sometimes it uses it meaning discriminating wisdom. So it can get a little confusing. And real is a bad word to use anyway. I mean, it's such a tricky term. I don't think philosophers get very uncomfortable with it. So, and the Course does seem to use it in a couple of ways, so it can be very confusing. Yeah. Thank you.
It's refreshing to hear other religions acknowledged rather than attacked. Since I've been only in the Course a short time, I find that there's a huge resistance to calling A Course in Miracles a religion. Is there not? And I have one other question, and I'll sit down. You can answer both. Before I came to the Course, I thought clearly that there was a mind, body, spirit. And it seemed like, as you were talking tonight, and the Course, as I'm looking at this moving Rorschach, it seems to not clearly differentiate mind. It seems like at one point it's talking about the mind being the Holy Spirit. It equates it to that. Other times it's talking to part of the mind being the ego. And I'm having trouble finding it. Is the mind the spirit, or am I the spirit, or that part of it? Could you clarify some of that?
Yeah, let's see. That's a tricky one for a couple of reasons. First off, we don't have an adequate vocabulary in English for mind and subjective experience. In Sanskrit, there are about 20 words for consciousness. It's like the Eskimos, you know, with a dozen words for snow. We just see snow. They see, you know, all the different types of snow. We need about 10 times as much vocabulary for our inner universe as we currently have in English, because we don't have the terminology to differentiate. Mind gets used in all sorts of ways. So I think your problem is certainly one I share. There is a section in the teacher's manual for teachers which it defines mind as the activating agent of spirit, but then it seems to use mind in some other ways as well, the mind of the Holy Spirit, of Christ's mind, etc. And it's made more complex by, as far as I can see, the way it's describing mind is the mind as kind of holographic, that any part of mind contains all minds. Every mind contains all minds, as it says. Is this meaningful to you? No, is what it says. So it makes clear that we can't fully understand the nature of mind in our unenlightened condition. And the term does get used in several ways, so I don't feel I can adequately answer the question, I'm afraid. It's a is the Course a religion? Boy, I think it would depend on your definition of religion. My understanding is the sociologists and so forth have these very esoteric definitions, which I don't understand. My understanding is there are a lot of different definitions, so take your pick. The Course says very clearly the teacher of God should remember the theoretical issues but waste time, so whether the Course is a religion or not, I don't know. I'd say what works for you. Maybe this would be a good time for us to do a guided meditation. What I'm going to ask you to do is just take a moment to relax and sit in a comfortable posture, and I'd suggest you adopt a kind of meditative posture, which the classic elements of a meditative posture, the most important of all, is just to sit with your back straight. And if you sit with the back straight, then usually the contraction in the muscles in the back is enough to maintain alertness. And if you just allow all the rest of the body to relax, then that will allow the body-mind to relax. So you maintain this combination of relaxed alertness, which is one of the key useful components of meditative practice. If you just take a moment to take a few deep breaths. And you might notice something interesting about the nature of breathing, and that is that you only have to exert effort to breathe in. And after you breathe in, you can just let go, and the air will fall out automatically by itself. And that as you allow the air to fall out, there's an automatic tendency for the muscles around the chest and shoulders to let go and relax. And there's an automatic tendency for that relaxation to spread through the body. As the body relaxes, the mind tends to quiet. And just take a moment to allow this relaxation to deepen. Just enjoy this relaxed state. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to visualize yourself in a particular place. Then I'm going to ask you to meet with a certain person or being and to engage in a dialogue, which I'll make some suggestions for. And all the time, just allow yourself to remain relaxed and comfortable. Now what I'd like you to do, all the time remaining relaxed and comfortable, breathing slowly and deeply, is just to visualize yourself in some place where you feel at peace, safe, content. Might be at home, might be in nature, might be anywhere. Just somewhere that draws you with a feeling of beauty and peace and warmth. And just look around at that place. And feel that place. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to bring someone into that environment with you. And the being I'd like you to bring in with you is going to be a great sage, a person of enormous wisdom, of unbounded love and compassion, of gentleness, honesty, patience. Someone who embodies true wisdom, someone who has embodied the Course, someone who manifests and expresses the deepest wisdom and love from which the Course was born. Now I'd like you to see that person approaching you and go to greet them. And as you greet, feel what it's like to be in the presence of someone who embodies and manifests and radiates the wisdom and love and compassion of the Course. Someone who has truly realized this teaching. And this person is available to help and serve you. And see if there's anything you would like to say to this sage. See if there's anything the sage would like to say to you. And what does it feel like to be with someone who accepts you completely? Who has no judgments of you whatsoever? Who understands you profoundly? And loves you unquestioningly. And see if there are any questions you would like to ask the sage. And see if there are any questions the sage would like to ask you. And ask the sage if he or she will be available to you in the future. and see if there's anything you want to say to the sage by way of completion. See if the sage has anything that he or she wants to say to you by way of completion. Now take a last look at this being. Recognize again that this is a being who has fully embodied the profundity, the wisdom, the boundless love, and the limitless compassion and understanding of the Course. This is a profoundly wise and loving being. This is a sage. This is a being in whom the mind which sourced the Course is present. And now realize that this being is a creation and projection of your own mind, and that those qualities abide within you. And as you remember this, begin to merge with the sage, so that your body and the body of the sage become one. And feel what it feels like to be interpenetrated and one with a being of pure love. Feel what it feels like to be totally accepting. Feel what it feels like to feel love and compassion for all beings. Feel what it's like to want from the depths of your being to heal and help all other beings. Feel what it's like to embody the mind and wisdom and love and compassion of the Course. And remember that this is a recognition, not a change at all. Remember, there's nothing that need be done to experience and express this, because this is what you always already are. And in just a moment, when you open your eyes, don't jump back into the room. Rather, just gently open to include the room and these apparently other people within the space of your love and compassion and open mind. And as you do, recognize that you desire for these people all that is best, that you truly, from the bottom of your being, desire their awakening and healing. And recognize also that every other person in this room desires your awakening and healing. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes and look around at yourself. And if you wish, you might just see if there's one thing you'd like to share with the person next to you. And if you want, you can take a moment to do that. Perhaps we could just take a moment to, first of all, express our gratitude to all the people from the Miracle Distribution Center who worked so hard to give us this evening together. Thank you very much indeed, all of you who've done that. And then we might remember that we've had lots of words tonight, but the message of the Course is very clear that all those 1,200 pages of words are actually only to point to what's beyond words, i.e. us. So perhaps this would be a nice note on which to finish. Simply do this. Be still. And lay aside all thoughts of what you are and what God is. All concepts you have learned about the world, all images you hold about yourself. Empty your mind of everything it thinks is either true or false, or good or bad, of every thought it judges worthy, and all the ideas of which it is ashamed. Hold on to nothing. Do not bring with you one thought the past has taught, nor one belief you ever learned before from anything. Forget this world. Forget this course. And come with wholly empty hands unto your God. Thank you very much. Blessings and peace. Thank you.